Welcome to Book Central.
Thanks, Chris. It's nice to be here.
Beth, more than 35 years ago, you moved from New Jersey to Minnesota, and that first Thanksgiving in the heartland, you attempted to make a local and seasonal meal, but it didn't quite turn out as expected for your family. Would you share one of your dishes that was perceived as a shortcoming, maybe, and one of your dishes that was accepted as a newer food?
Yeah. Well, you know, it was really interesting because we always had this enormous turkey that was this big bronze hero. You know, it was raised commercially, and it was very pretty, but it was always really sort of dry and leathery because it's hard to cook an enormous turkey and get the timing right. And there is a big difference between turkeys that are a little bit smaller, they're raised locally, they're free-range turkeys, they tend to have larger thighs and smaller breasts. They're not quite as pretty when you cook them, and because at that time it was only my husband and I and then my original family of six people that, you know, we had a small group. So I got a 12-pound turkey. Actually, it was a 10-pound turkey probably that was free-range, and of course my father thought it was a chicken, and, and he couldn't imagine that that would really look or taste like the turkey that he knew. Of course, the turkey that, you know, I'd grown up with it was more of a carrier than anything else. It carried the mashed potatoes and the cranberry sauce and things like that. So nobody ever really paid attention to the bird or how it was raised until I began talking to farmers at market and learning the difference between how poultry is raised and managed and what a difference that makes in flavor.
And
so that was one example, yeah.
And were you introduced, I mean, when I moved out to the Midwest, ironically, I don't think I knew about kale. And man, you know, people eat it all the time. I do. Was that something new for you when you moved from the East Coast?
It was completely new. I had no idea what it was, and I didn't know what to do with it. And it was thanks to a wonderful farmer and a dear friend, Atina Diffley, who's also a writer, who I'm going to give a shout-out to her book. It's called Turn Here, Sweet Corn.
Oh, sure.
It's a fabulous, fabulous memoir. And she looked at me and she said, oh, honey, all you need to do is take this, chop it up, throw it in, you know, the saute pan with a little bit of vegetable oil and a lot of garlic. And then when it comes out, you know, when you've sauteed it up and it gets nice and tender, you just pull it out and you dump a lot of brown sesame, dark sesame oil all over it, and then you put a little soy sauce on it and just a little bit of honey. And she said, and then she kind of looked at me and she said, but of course, you know, gravel would taste good that way too. But she was right. It's a great way to cook kale. So that's, I've cooked it that way ever since. Super simple. Yeah.
And there's quite a heredity as one of your main themes throughout the book, where it seems like people and food weave together, especially in particular places. You just mentioned a few folks out here. But growing up, who was your family member growing up who connected you with food?
It was my grandmother. I mean, my mother was super busy, and I was the oldest in the family. And so, and she had twins when I was, about 10, 12 years old. And so I spent a lot of time with my grandmother, and she was a wonderful gardener and a terrific cook, and she loved doing everything herself. I mean, that's kind of what you did. You know, you rolled up your sleeves and you got to work. And so I spent a lot of time with her baking bread and rolling pie crusts and making cookies, but also cooking real food because she trusted me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, that was the one thing that I learned. My mother always thought it was a hassle, and I understand that, to have, you know, kids in the kitchen helping out, but that's how I fell in love with food, by simply doing it and feeling like a grown-up because I could. And I found with my own kids that, you know, every kid likes to play with fire and knives. It could be anything more thrilling. So so that's how I got into it.
And it's definitely important to bring children into the kitchen, but even maybe before the kitchen, be taking them to market and the stores.
Yeah.
And you uniquely had that experience in New Jersey growing up, or within the Upper East Coast. And that was with your grandmother as well?
Yeah, it was. She had a, you know, we lived on the East Coast of New Jersey. She lived in a little town called Maplewood, and we would drive down the coast, she had a summer home on the New Jersey shore, and so we would drive down the old Highway 35 and stop at every farm stand, and she knew every farmer by name. So, you know, she knew that, you know, Mavis had the best peaches, and George had the best blueberries, and then Henry had the best corn, and we would stop at each of these little farm stands, and she would talk to the farmers and you know, share recipes with them. Some of them clipped from the Newark Star-Ledger, and when we got back to the kitchen, she would steam up crabs from Spike Fish Market or sizzle up burgers from Bert's, you know, butcher shop. And everything that was on the table when I was at her home came from a place and a person that had a name. And I just remember that because there would always be a story with it. You know, she knew all of these people. She knew their families. They knew her family. And there would be an exchange of information that just made the partaking in that meal that much richer, because you felt when you were creating the meal or sitting down and sharing with people, there were other people there too, not just the people you were having dinner with, but the people that had provided the food. And it really, again, created, you know, this word gets bandied around a lot, but it did create a sense of community and of shared interest, because over the years, you know, by the time I went to college, some of those people had kids that were going to college too. You know, I mean, it was, and even though you saw them maybe just in the summer once a week, you did have these conversations and they became part of our lives.
And there's always seemingly that person in every family who has control of, they say, you know, the checkbook or the key to the food cupboard. And your grandmother was surely that for you. And I'm assuming that you were that person in your family, especially with your three boys. And they grew up uniquely at a Montessori school called the Land School. And I kind of wanted to hear about their lessons that they've incorporated now that your boys have grown up in their food and cooking habits. What do you see them bringing from their learning to the table?
They really like to cook, for starts, but they also, I think, if nothing else, you know, as much as they griped and groaned about having to do chores at the Land School, they appreciate what it goes into raising vegetables, to collecting eggs, to mucking out the barn, all those kinds of things. And I just to clarify for a minute, the Land School is a campus that's part of Lake Country Montessori School that's actually in Minneapolis.
Okay.
But the junior high students, the Land School is a resource for the lower school because they go out there for, I guess you could call them field days, but they spend a full day out there once a month doing chores or doing a science project and stuff at the lower level. And then the junior high students have extended periods of time out there. So they'll go out there anywhere from 3 weeks to 6 weeks, depending on what the rotation is, and live on the farm and engage in the farm work. And Montessori's vision was that the adolescent really needs to have to bring together everything they've learned in the classroom with real-life experience, and she thought the farm was the place to do it. So it fits within Montessori's pedagogy for that age. So that's how that evolved. And for a while, I taught both English and cooking out at the Land School. And, so my students as well as my kids had that experience, too. So I there's something... I think important whether you're gardening with your kids, and even if it's in a pot, you know, of herbs out the back door, just to see that cycle of you know, where our food comes from.
That it just doesn't come from, you know, a package at the store.
Exactly. It just changes, I think, the way you think about food and how much you buy and what you throw away. It's sort of an argument against our food being so disposable, you know, really too cheap or thought of as being cheap.
It seems like all of the lessons have to do with the soil health, that it's important. And you could maybe tap into that, talking about the genetic health of families being linked to the soil, to the land.
That's exactly right. Yeah. When you see it firsthand and you understand the microbial activity in the soil and what a difference that makes to the health of the plant and to then how the food tastes and, you know, all those kinds of things. And for me, it really started with flavor. And I think for kids, they're very responsive to flavor, especially when they're young. They can taste the difference between a carrot that's grown in California with chemicals and one that's grown in the backyard. There's a huge difference.
Sure. Sure. There's definitely a reason why certain kids say they don't like their vegetables, because we wouldn't like them either.
Exactly. In fact, you know, there's a school in Minneapolis, outside Minneapolis and Hopkins, where that school system began buying directly from a local farm, organic farmer, and they saw an enormous difference in the food waste.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the kids were actually eating those twice-baked potatoes. They weren't just taking them and taking two bites and throwing them away.
And even behavioral issues. I know that gets kind of iffy with some folks, but I've definitely heard that too, is that if you're having locally organically grown meals, I mean, one, you're probably more likely to eat all of it and have energy
right.
throughout the day, so not right. then to be a, you know, behavioral disturbance during school.
Yep, exactly. Well, I think a lot of it too is that we really still don't understand precisely the difference in, you know, sugar, salt, fat, that, and the stabilizers that are used in processed foods. And a lot of the food that comes into school cafeterias is processed and then just reheated.
Mm. Mm-hmm. It's not even cooking.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
You got to know a lot of younger people throughout the Twin Cities, through the land school, but then also through the farmers markets. I think of this one person, Tamika, from
yes.
the youth farm, and
yes.
also Myvang, part of a Hmong family of growers.
Yeah.
When did you get to know them, and where do you see these younger people taking agriculture?
You know, that's a great question. I'm really hopeful. I kind of feel like, you know, the millennials are really a terrific generation. I'm so proud of a lot of the work these younger people are doing. So Myvang is, she grew up picking, and so did Paku Hong, picking, harvesting pickles for Gedney Pickle,
mm-hmm.
the big pickle company around here. And then her family also had a huge garden on the side, and they would harvest their vegetables and bring them to the farmer's market. And the Hmong have been, I think, instrumental in changing the complexion of the farmer's markets, because they've introduced us to so many interesting foods just the way generations of other immigrants have before them, so that the foods that they grew in their backyard and then, you know, brought to the farmer's market really became part of our diet. And that's where, you know, cilantro came from, you know, a number of the Mexican and Latino immigrants. And we saw a lot of those Hmong hot peppers and some of the different kinds of eggplants and vegetables coming into the market as a result of the work that the Hmong are doing. And I think, you know, what I found really interesting, too, is that the Hmong who live here now are second generation, but their parents lived very close to the land, and they taught their kids how to cook.
Mm-hmm.
And so by getting to be friends with Ma Vang and with Paku Hung, who founded the Hmong American Farmers Association, which is the first and largest Hmong American Farmers Association in the country, they're doing really remarkable work, both around growing, around you know, getting involved in the economics of farming. So the Hmong American Farmers Association has bought a huge parcel of land up in Hugo, Minnesota, that is an incubator farm for other Hmong farmers. And then they're helping them figure out through business planning and that kind of thing how to own their own land so that they can then grow and make it either a second income or a primary income. And it's been great. And I hope I'm answering the question. But
yeah.
Okay. My had, you know, and this is true of a lot of these younger people that are, you know, second generation Hmong. She wanted, you know, and Paku felt this way too. They wanted to be Americans. So when they were teenagers, they hated working on the farm. That was the worst thing in the world. And a lot of people that have grown up in farm families are grown up, you know, going to the farmer's market. It's really hard work.
Mm-hmm.
And then when she got to college, and she's now, Mai is now working her way into becoming a full-time farmer, but she also works as an interpreter at the Hennepin County Medical Center. And so she realized once she got through college, how much she missed that and the farming and being close to the land and being with her family on the land. And when she became a mother herself, she realized that she wanted to provide that experience for her children, because working together outside, as hard as it was, that's where she heard the stories of her family. And so it was that collective effort, you know, working with elders, you know, everybody sharing in the profits of, you know, whatever that endeavor was. And I think it's true of any small family business, that everybody has some skin in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, you know, it's hard work, but it's also joyous. And so that intrigued me. I wanted to know more about that. So I got to be friends with them just by going to the farmer's market and got invited to a meal.
And there's quite an importance, too, like you mentioned, of immigrants bringing new foods to the American plate. And sometimes we forget that you go 20 years back, 50 years back, 100 years back, our palate and our plate keeps expanding. And these immigrant groups are in addition to bring up a seat to the table for them. And just like you got to know younger folks, you do chronicle a bit about aging and the death of your parents, specifically your father, who seemed like a man that you shared a language of cooking with. Can you recall communing with your father and his love of smelly cheese and and how you ended up making cheese at Shepherd's Way Farms, which I found really amazing, maybe even a way that you were able to think of him again?
My dad loved everything. He had a huge appetite, and he was very gregarious. After he served in the Navy, and after World War II, he and one of his buddies just took off and bummed around Europe, and he experienced, you know, and my heritage is both English, but it's also Alsatian. And so he and this friend of his sort of traveled all through the Alsace-Lorraine area, and they went into France, and then they went up into God knows where they went. But they bummed around for a while before he came back and went to college on the GI Bill. And he never forgot, you know, just the joy he took in meeting people and tasting these different foods. I mean, he loved it. And so he was just really interested in food, and he traveled for his work. He worked for a propane company, and that took him all over the country. And wherever he went, he would engage with people by you know, taking his customers out for dinner someplace. But he always wanted to go someplace local, and he was a very good mimic too. He would come back and he would just nail their accents. And if we were traveling as a family, wherever we went, he could pick up. You know, he could identify where someone was from by their accent. So he was just fascinated with anything that had to do with people and their language and their culture, and food was a big part of that. So when my parents would come out for Thanksgiving, he loved going to the farmer's market, because there's so many sights and sounds and smells and interesting people to talk to. And there's a wonderful woman, Mary Falk, who has a farm, Love Tree Farm Cheese, and she had really stinky cheese. It's great. I mean, she cave ages her cheese. And it's remarkable cheese. And it's always different every time you go, because, you know, she really plays with the microbial activity in the milk that creates the different flavors in the cheese. And it's a sheep's milk cheese. Sometimes she does a sheep's cow blend. And, you know, throughout the year, the flavors in that cheese are going to change depending on what the sheep are eating. You know, the grass has changed during the year. And then what's happening in the cave, it's damper in there sometimes, and it's not quite so damp the next time. There's always kind of a misty, tule-y fog that comes in off the meadow that makes a big difference in the how that, you know, cheese ripens. And it's cool. I mean, you go down into her cave. Well, one of the things I tried to do in that piece about cheese and how it's, you know, how alive it is, you know, cheese is really just milk in the process of decay.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, we're part of that cycle, right? And so, you know, not to get too sort of woo-woo about it, but I took a group of school kids up to Mary's farm one afternoon. It was a beautiful afternoon, and the kids were romping around with the sheep, and they got to bottle feed this little orphaned lamb that, you know, that had, the mom had died, it was a wonderful, wonderful day. The kids just loved it. And then Mary invited me to come down into the cave where she and her husband had built this cave to replicate the conditions of the cheeses. When she was studying cheese making, she went over to the Basque area in Spain. And so they dug this cave into the hillside to replicate those ripening, or it's called affinage, which means finishing of the cheese. And, and she had these wheels, and, you know, I realized it was sort of this really interesting moment that there's so much in our regulatory system around keeping everything clean.
Sure, that kind of like sanitation is the way to control the mystery of decay.
Exactly right.
And
exactly.
I was wondering, and kind of hearing you say that death is obviously necessary for life, and there's some kind of weird fear with Americans fearing death, fearing this unknown. And it sounds like from this experience that that you were able not, you know, to make your father alive again, but to go into a ceremony of where you are understanding that his death is part of life. We're actually going to take a short break here.
Great.
You're listening to Book Central. Support for this program is provided by Plot Twist Bookstore in Ankeny, a place where book lovers can browse, talk, and meet. Open daily. For hours and more information, go to plottwistbookstore.com. So we're back. If you're just joining me, my guest today is Beth Dooley, author of the memoir In Winter's Kitchen, Growing Roots and Breaking Bread in the Northern Heartland, out in paperback from Milkweed Editions in Minnesota. Before the break, we were talking about her heredity of food from old family dishes to new growing traditions. Beth, you grew up in an age that claimed the personal is political.
Yeah.
And when you first moved to Minnesota, you worked for a marketing firm that represented some agribusiness accounts. Did you feel any conflict between earning a living selling corporate food while wanting to keep in sight your ideals and goals of eating locally, seasonally, organically? You talk about one person in particular who kind of helped you bridge that divide.
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. Two things were going on. One, I knew at that point in my career that I really, really wanted to write about food. And I didn't know how to quite break into that. And so writing, you know, marketing copy and advertising copy and working on cookbook brochures and things like that for these, you know, corporate food companies, I knew was a way to build up a portfolio to do that. At the same time, I had joined a CSA, the Red Cardinal Farm, which was one of the first CSAs in our area, and did a trade with them. So I was writing their newsletter, and I learned a tremendous amount about organic farming doing that. And so that would be kind of, I had my day job, and then I had my night job. And the person you're referring to was the head of marketing and advertising in Minneapolis for our biggest client, Pacific Gamble Robinson, and he was a great guy. And he hunted and fished and trapped. He had a beautiful garden. He made his own bread. And he was very much at peace with what he was doing. I mean, he, you know, he kind of lived his life and got his paycheck. And I think a lot of us live that way without, you know, and there was no way I could judge him. He was a really, really good man. And I think, you know, it's important to remember, I work with a lot of people that, a lot of younger people, actually, that are working for big food companies in Minneapolis, because there are a couple of them, and they have their day jobs, and then at night they're on bike teams. They all have big gardens, or they belong to CSAs, or they pitch in at the farmers market to help their friends who have farms. I mean, it's really interesting how both how strong this local food movement is, and I think it can operate pretty well under the shadow of corporate food.
Hmm.
You know, and I think, you know, we all live with conflicts in our lives. And, yeah, sure, it was a conflict. And but at the same time, I just wanted to write. And so,
yep.
You know, so that was what was driving that. I wanted to get better at what I was doing. And it gave me, you know, I'm grateful for the opportunity to have built up a portfolio that I could then use to get the kind of work that I wanted.
And the company that Jim worked for, Pacific Gamble Robinson, was one of the companies that branded apples. I found that really interesting.
Yep.
Especially because apples once were such an amazingly varied crop in the upper Midwest, something like 15,000 varieties, and now there's 3,000.
Yep.
And there's kind of two sides to this apple growing, either saving old varieties and creating new ones. Can you tell me about this division, especially in your research and visits around the upper Midwest?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, and there's, again, you begin to peel back the onion on a lot of these food issues and you realize how complicated they are. You know, the story of the Red Delicious apple, of course, if anybody is old enough to remember the Red Delicious apple that used to be wrapped in cellophane, and that's all we had for a long time in New Jersey anyway, were these Red Delicious, and they were mushy and they didn't taste very good. And, of course, they were grown and shipped and held beyond their time from the growers along the West Coast. Well, the University of Minnesota pretty much single-handedly reversed that by creating a hybrid, the Honeycrisp, that became wildly popular because it's an apple that's bred to have larger cells that contain a lot of water or juice. It's very crisp and very sweet. And that, sort of lit, really, the interest in apples again. And as a result of that, people became interested, again, in the different varieties of apples and some of the heirloom varieties, which, as you said, used to grow throughout the upper Midwest. We used to be one of the biggest apple-growing regions in the country, and we have the potential to be so again. Thanks to the work of Dan Bussey down at Seed Savers and their heritage orchards, a lot of those heirloom varieties, which are truly delicious, are being reintroduced to our markets. And one of the things Dan does is he runs around the country and he finds wild apples or apples that are truly heirloom apples, brings them back, and then grafts them into other trees to produce terrific heirloom varieties of apples. A lot of this too is being driven by the hard cider movement, because hard ciders rely on not just sweet apples, but what people in the business call spitters, because they contain a lot of tannins. But that's what those apples with a lot of tannins in them that to us taste bitter, or they create that dry sensation in the back of your mouth. Those apples add to the complexity and balance out the sweetness in the apples that we grow for eating out of hand. So, you know, there's a lot of things going on in the apple industry that I find very hopeful. What Dan would like to see is that everyone having available to them varieties of apples that that are good for different culinary purposes. Like, you know, here's an apple that's great for eating fresh. Here's another apple that cooks really well. Here's another apple that's great for turning into apple butter or making a pie with, you know, those kinds of things. And then, of course, the balance of apples that are used in making hard cider, which is really America's first alcoholic beverage. And that story is really interesting. People used to drink cider the way they drank water. Because water was dangerous, and so you were safer drinking hard cider, and they gave it to their kids. And milk, you know, you didn't really drink milk because milk was reserved for making cheese, or milk was turned into butter because, again, milk soured quickly, and so you really didn't want to have it around. So, you know, there are all these kinds of things that are coming back again.
And there's other stories about coming back. I understand it's difficult for agribusiness to lament the loss of different varieties of apples because they don't make money from bringing back memories.
Right.
However, you include the names of some lost varieties, sheep nose, Shenango, strawberry, cow's snout.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's sad to just hear the loss of those names because it's just such unique language.
It is. They're really fun. But there are people beginning to grow them again.
Right.
So we're hoping that they'll hang in there. And that's the other thing. I mean, again, when people taste them and they appreciate their flavor and then they understand the benefit that these apples have to the land because they're terrific pollinators, for instance, they really have value beyond. I mean, they taste good. That's you know, a compelling reason enough for me to go seek them out. But they also have terrific environmental benefits as well, and they're beautiful.
And later in the book, you talk about some more restoration ecology of one of the seemingly lost trees. So this is kind of a hopeful story here, the American chestnut. Can you recount a little bit about how that tree began to disappear from the landscape and how it now might be reappearing?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, to me, this is one of the great stories of what's going on in the local food movement. There's a researcher, his name is Phil Rutter, and he has a research firm called Badger Set Research. It's in Canton, Minnesota, which is right on the Iowa-Minnesota border. And he's a tree specialist. He's an agricultural restoration ecologist. And he became fascinated about 40 years ago with the American chestnut. Now, the American chestnut tree was wiped out with a blight back in the 1940s, a long time ago. At the Botanical Garden in New York, somebody brought in, decorative Chinese chestnuts, which is a lower, shrubbier, very pretty tree, but it carried a blight, and that blighted tree, that fungus, it's actually a fungus that's carried on the wind, spread like wildflower throughout the eastern states. And any place that had chestnuts, especially along the Appalachian Trail, was struck by this blight. It took about 50 years, and those trees were gone. And the Forest Service, realizing that those trees were sick, and cut them all down, and then used those used the wood to build the fence posts along the Appalachian Trail. So if you're going to hike the Appalachian Trail, those fence posts are still there, and the reason being that that chestnut wood is a really hard, beautiful wood, and it is really weather resistant. It makes gorgeous furniture, and the but the chestnuts were pretty much gone, except for a stand in central Wisconsin, kind of not too like north of La Crosse a little bit, and in the center of the state, there was a homesteader that brought the chestnuts with him in his pocket, and he planted those chestnuts, and those trees survived the blight by virtue of the fact that they were far enough away from the East Coast. They since, within the past 10 years, have begun to become blighted, but that gave stock for Phil, who is one of the founding members of the American Chestnut Foundation, to really dig in and begin his work back crossing the American chestnut with the Chinese variety to create a tree that is grows as tall as the American chestnut once did, and yet be blight resistant. And they are beautiful trees. The American they're called Americanoid chestnut, but they have the same characteristics as the American chestnut tree. They can grow to be about 20 feet high. They can have it. You know, when they're really getting going, they can have a trunk that's about the size of a dining room table, and they have a really tremendous root system that goes way down. So it's a terrific tree because it's very prolific, and the chestnut itself is a very nutritious nut. It's really high in protein. It dries well, and you can make a flour out of it, which is what the Europeans do. And then it's simply a delicious nut to score and roast. And it's wonderful to see these trees coming back because in July, for instance, when they flower, it looks like the whole hillside is covered with snow. I mean,
oh wow, beautiful,
beautiful trees. And so, you know, thanks to Phil. And the other thing about these trees is because of their deep root system, they are able to withstand drought and flooding. They are nitrogen fixers, so their leaves are loaded with nitrogen, and when their leaves fall, then they help fix the soil, you know, if the soil needs amendments. And they're being planted in some of the areas throughout the country that have been strip mined because they grow really well in these damaged areas, and they'll return the wildlife to the area, and they'll fix the soil, and they have all these other benefits. A lot of the permaculture farmers are planting them around their farms because they provide tremendous windbreak, and then they're also great animal fodder as well. So they're great trees.
And they also bring back a memory with your grandmother and her stuffing, which was great to read about. We're actually going to take another short break here.
Yep.
You're listening to Book Central. Thank you. This program is supported by Humanities Iowa and the National Endowment for the Humanities. The views and opinions expressed by this program do not necessarily reflect those of Humanities Iowa or the National Endowment for the Humanities. We're back. Before the break, I was talking to my guest, Beth Dooley, about the loss and preservation of foods in the Northern Heartland. Beth wrote about her insights into investigating our food system in her book, In Winter's Kitchen. Beth, throughout your book, I read about small farmers who have other jobs or who are married to a spouse with a town job or have a university job, and I considered the parallels of these farmers with independent writers. Perhaps they work odd jobs or they must teach. And I wondered what other work you did as a writer. Some was that marketing work, but both food-related and non.
You know, I've done a lot of things. I've taught at different levels. I've taught at the college level. I've taught at both private universities, University of St. Thomas, and I've taught at Minneapolis Community College, which I loved. I've taught junior high at school, the Montessori school I mentioned earlier that my kids went to. And then I've also taught cooking at different cooking schools. So a lot of different things. I've also worked as a writer for, as we mentioned earlier, for advertising companies. And then I do still do some freelance writing for different co-ops that have newsletters. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, all those different activities. I did for a while work as a communications director for a wonderful organization called Wilderness Inquiry. It's an outdoor education and outfitting organization. It's a nonprofit, but they are their mission is to get everybody who doesn't have access to the outdoors out into the wilderness. Mm-hmm. So it has big Voyager canoes that we take students from the Minneapolis pool school system out onto the Mississippi River for not only just the adventure of it, but also science projects, and they do a lot of writing for their English curriculum when they get back. So I've worked in that capacity as well. So lots of different things. I think as a writer, you can do a lot of different things. You have to do a lot.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
For sure. And you wrote that your career changed when you met one woman, and specifically your food writing career changed for the better. For those who don't know her, would you share who she is and how meeting her changed your career?
Yes, it's Lucia Watson, and she actually just recently sold her restaurant, Lucia's Restaurant. Mm. It was up for a number of James Beard Awards. It's won all kinds of awards from, regional awards. It won an award from IATP, Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. I mean, she was really sort of the Alice Waters of our region.
Mm.
And so she sourced a lot of her food from the local farmers, and she was really the first chef to make a big difference in raising up the profile of local ingredients. And she would talk about them on the menu, and her servers would tell people where the food came from and why it tasted so good. She understood that as a small business person, it was important to the local economy to support other small business people. So she got the entire picture. And she and I began working together because prior to meeting her, I had written a couple of cookbooks that were doing pretty well, but I also knew that I needed to partner with a chef in order to write a bigger book, a more important book, because I'm not a commercial cook. I didn't have that as a background.
Mm-hmm.
And so she and I met actually through another mutual friend, and we became friends right away. We had, we loved dogs, and so we just became friends by taking our naughty dogs out to run around in the park and go off leash. we became friends that way, and because we shared a mutual interest in food, we just agreed that we'd collaborate on a cookbook together, and we were lucky enough to land a proposal with Judith Jones, who is a legendary cookbook editor. She had pretty much discovered Julia Child. And if anybody has seen the movie Julie and Julia, the editor, the actor who plays the editor, Judith Jones, in that movie, got it exactly right. She was a terrific editor. She was very clear about what made a good recipe, that it needed to have voice, that it needed to go beyond just being instructive, but it needed to have warmth and a human touch to it. She really guided us in understanding that the Northern Heartland is a very specific region unto itself, that people prior to that time had lumped the North and the, you know, that there is a real difference between the upper Midwest and the southern Midwest.
Sure.
And so she helped us define what the Northern Heartland really meant. And to do that, Lucia and I just dug in and did a lot of research. And Lucia worked on the recipe end of it, and I worked on the research end of it. And it was a really remarkable collaboration. And I learned a lot from her about cooking techniques and you know, what kind of defines a good dish and how things work together. It took me from beyond being a pretty good home cook, and it got me out of that sort of gourmet magazine kind of narrow view of what makes good food.
Mm-hmm.
She
mm-hmm.
really responded to, she was a very responsive chef. She would look at ingredients and kind of know intuitively what to do with them rather than, you know, have a shopping list or look at a recipe and stick specifically to it. And so I learned a lot that way as well.
And uniquely, this is your first memoir, a book mm-hmm. that incorporates memory along with research. So what differences and similarities did you find in writing this book versus your cookbooks like Savoring the Seasons with Watson?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, one of the things that makes writing cookbooks a little bit easier is that they are more prescriptive. They're more narrow in focus. And so, but that said, you still have to research the backstory. You still have to know, for me anyway, I want to know, again, what defines flavor or why something works particularly well, because I want to share that information with the reader. I want them to feel as though we're standing next to each other in the kitchen and I'm talking about how to reduce the sauce or, you know, things like that. But I can only know that by both doing it myself and also going out and finding other people that do that well. So so there still is the same amount of research that goes into, you know, into writing a cookbook. But what I never had the sort of luxury of doing before or the challenge of doing before was taking that and expanding on it. So In Winter's Kitchen gave me the opportunity to both expand the research that I had been doing anyway and go back and revisit a lot of the farmers who I knew, who I'd written about, but ask them more questions, to research a little more about the impact of policy on our food, to research the environmental impact of what these different growing methods had on our land and our water, those kinds of things, and writing it as, you know, nonfiction allowed me to expand on that research component of it. At the same time, again, it was a challenge, but it was an opportunity to understand my own relationship to and my own personal history to food, because I think everybody, it's so personal. Everybody comes into, to, you know, food, which I think, and actually I know a lot of other people feel, is really the biggest issue of our time. And it's a very personal issue. And it's the one thing that we all, you know, it's really one of the things we all share. We all need to eat, and as humans, we all can cook. So those two things both define who we are and connect us in a really fundamental way. And so I wanted to explore that in my writing as well.
And there's definitely the importance of that personal narrative on top of the imperative. Listeners should know that there are terrific recipes in Winter's Kitchen in the back. I tried some of them, and I still have a few more to go. And we've got Thanksgiving next week, so that's terrific.
Yeah, thanks.
Going back to the beginning, when you moved from New Jersey to Minnesota, you left behind a job at a New York publishing firm, and your books have been published, like you said, through university presses, independent presses. How would you consider presses like Milkweed, the publisher of In Winter's Kitchen, and its ethic compared to local foods and that movement?
You know, there's a lot of similarities. It's really about relationships. I have a phenomenal relationship with everybody at Milkweed. First of all, they're right down the street.
So that's nice.
When I want to meet with my editor or if I want to pick up more books for myself, I can just bike down there. And that's really great. It makes a huge difference to be able to see and meet and have coffee with and really work on things directly with the people that are engaged in something I care so deeply about, because writing, again, is intensely personal, just like cooking. So that's been enormous. And just there's a different level of accountability. I know the people that are out there selling my books. I know the people that are packing them up and shipping them out. I know the people that are writing the press releases. They all really care about, you know, what happens to my work, because we're working together. We like each other. It's a much deeper, I think, more satisfying relationship, and I'm really grateful to be able to work that way. I have nothing against Knopf. I think they did a fine job with Savoring the Seasons, the first book that I wrote with Lucia Watson,
mm-hmm.
and it's a wonderful cookbook. It ended up, when it went out of hardback, it was picked up by the University of Minnesota Press, which is also a wonderful local press. But I have to tell you that beyond my editor, Judith Jones, I was Lucia and I were, you know, two little sort of nobodies in mm-hmm. this enormous corporation. And at the time that our book was published, Gloria Vanderbilt's book on housekeeping or something came out, you know, and decorating came out. And who do you think they're going to pay attention to? They could have, you know, they just weren't interested in, you know, these two little authors from Central Minnesota. You know, but when I work with Milkweed, they really, really care. They think I'm important, and that makes a big difference.
And Beth, the epilogue to your memoir ends beautifully, just like the entire book is a beautiful book, where you welcome people into the season, the holidays. I can imagine, and you even said at the beginning, the first fat snowflakes are falling slowly, gently, covering the faded backyards across the upper Midwest. And they'll be doing that as people gather around in their kitchens to make food for their friends and family. Thank you for writing such a personal and informative and wonderful book and talking with me today about it.
Oh, Chris, thank you. It's really been my pleasure. It's terrific. Thank you.
Beth Dooley is the author of In Winter's Kitchen. You've been listening to Book Central. I'm Chris Viviora. Our theme music was composed by Will Pett.